Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the first of our Peace and Justice series for the summer. This year, as you all have read, we've decided to follow Jim's series on the elements of various faiths with a series that looks at social justice within these. Just to remind you, next week, Karen Hochberg is going to come and talk about social justice in Judaism. Her topic is the prophetic voice of Islam, of reform, Judaism and social justice. Today, our guest is Dr. Ed Brett, and I have to confess that I have known Ed for probably 25 years, I guess. Ed is retired from La Roche College, where I also taught. I have to say that he is one of the reasons that I miss teaching at La Roche College. It's a small college, which means that people from different departments actually can get to know one another and have lunch together and have lots of conversations. We did this for many years. We went through four elections. We went through the earlier pope. I was not there when Francis was elected, and I'm sorry, because I'm sure that was a celebration, because his position is one that I think we all can rejoice in. Ed is a scholar. He has a PhD from Rutgers University. He was a professor of history and political science at La Roche for 30 years?
Yeah, even more. About 33 years, I think.
33. Well, that's a good number. Okay. He's the author of three books and working on the fourth, as I understand. He won the prestigious Christopher Award for one of the earlier books. He's the author of numerous scholarly articles, chapters in books. I think they even did a TV session on one of the books that you had written. His emphasis is on U.S. foreign policy and U.S. and Latin American religious history. Throughout my time of knowing Ed, I know him to be a person of deep faith. He has a heart for the poor and the marginalized, and I think that he has found a way to marry his professional life with his faith life. So I think this is a wonderful thing when this happens, and I'm really glad to have known him. It sounds like a eulogy. I'm really glad
to have known him, to know him.
I'm really glad to know him. That is right. So anyway, before we welcome Ed, I would like to begin with a word of prayer. God of us all, we thank you for the time together to consider your world. We thank you for laying the concerns on our hearts and for giving us the skills and the strength and the energy to address them. We particularly thank you for Ed, who has had the courage and the energy and the skills to speak truth to power on behalf of those least among us. We ask you to be with him and to be with us throughout this time. Amen. Okay, you're on.
Okay, they gave me this thing here so you can hear me, but I have a really booming voice anyway, so you probably don't need it. But Roberta and your pastor had invited me to, if I could, to attend services with you after this. And I said I couldn't because my two grandkids and my daughter are visiting. And I promised a long time ago that I would take them to something in, what is it, Evans City, where I don't think I've ever been, called the Zombie Museum. So this should be a really interesting afternoon. And I'll bring my 7-year-old grandson, who just turned 7 on July 2nd. I have a terrible sense of direction, so I got up really early to get ready. I was here an hour and a half early, I think. Because my directions actually worked. Oh, okay, there you go. But I was down there getting something to eat, And I hear the little pitter-patter coming from upstairs, and it's the set, the newly seven-year-old. And he says, Pop-Pop, so you're going to go give a talk today, huh? And I said, that's right. And then we can go to the zombie museum. That's right. And he says, you're like that guy Martin? I said, Martin, who? He says, you know, that guy who gives talks. And I said, Martin, who? And he said, you know, the guy who said that I want to see my four little kids live with black and white people together. And he's saying all of this stuff. And I thought, hey, his mother's and us are doing something right. I was really moved by that. But I don't think I'm, if you're expecting me to be like Martin, I think you'll be very much disappointed. But I'll do the best I can. But certain things are going, you know, at least the grandkids are learning about that type of thing. I'd like to start by saying, after the election of Donald Trump, a lot of people were upset. And out in the North Hills, you know, some people weren't. But out in the North Hills, at St. Paul's Methodist Church, the pastor there decided to call, to have a deal where people from all the different churches in the North Hills could come together just to talk about our situation, where we stand in the United States today, and what we can do for social justice, and so forth. And since I am involved in a lot of things in social justice, I was asked if, you know, people would be sitting at little tables with about seven or eight people at each table. So I was asked to be one of the leaders at the table when we start and so forth. And so I got to the table, and I'm supposed to ask people who they are and why they're here and so forth. And at my table, the people are going around, and this one woman says, my name is so-and-so, and I used to, well, people were saying what their religious faith is and so forth, and she said, I used to be a Catholic, but I'm not anymore. I'm now an Episcopalian. And I thought that was interesting. She said, because the Catholic Church doesn't believe in social justice. And I was, whoa, man, you know. So I said, well, I don't think I can agree with you on that. And she said, oh, they don't this and that, you know. Anyway, I let it go because that's not what this was all about. But when I got home, it really bothered me. And it's been bothering me ever since. And I can understand why she feels that way, but she's wrong. But I understand. And that's something maybe later we can get into a little bit. I think all churches, all churches, the Presbyterian Church, the Catholic Church, you name it, we all have our good side, but we have some dark things in our history. You know it, and I know it. And that's just the way it is, and we have to make sure that we get rid of those dark things and, you know, make the most of the good things. That's what religion is all about. And I was thinking about this again. It seems like I'm perpetually thinking about what this woman had to say. I don't know why. But as I was driving over here, and I had NPR on, and I was listening to a woman who had just written a book. She had been brought up in the Brethren Church, and it was an extreme church of the Brethren. And she was talking about the horrors of her childhood. Finally, her parents got out of it when the head pastor was caught. He was 70 years old or 68 years old or so, with a younger married parishioner in a situation, well, you can figure it out yourself, but, you know, and the church fell apart as a result. And I'm thinking, you know, we all have these kinds of moments, all of us churches, unfortunately, and that's why all of us have to be concerned with social justice and doing, you know, the most for it. The Catholic Church, which that woman evidently didn't know, we have our bad points as well as our good points in history, but for centuries, we've had a strong commitment to social justice. And let me just throw out a few people here, just as, I mean, there's way more that I could throw out, but in history, who really made an impact when it comes to social justice. In the middle of the the early part of the 16th century, for instance, a woman in Italy named Angela Merci. She saw in her part of Italy how young girls were just being had no chance of education and so forth. And so she decided to form a group to do something that wasn't being done, to educate young women, especially poor women, you know, young girls, especially poor girls. And so she founded a group which she called the Community of St. Ursula. Now, they were not going to be nuns. Nuns stayed behind cloistered walls, and they weren't supposed to be part of the community. They stayed and they prayed for the community, which I have my problems with, but that's another story. But that's not what she wanted. So she didn't want to be a nun. And she founded a group of women who actually lived in community, and they lived a celibate life without any vows, and they began teaching poor people. And they founded orphanages and so forth, and they made a difference. And her organization, which was called eventually the Ursulines, spread worldwide. They were the first Catholic nuns in what today is the United States, for instance. Came to my hometown in New Orleans. And some of the first nuns to try to educate slaves and so forth. But anyway, they were quite successful. But then, you know what happens? The Pope involves himself and he says, this isn't good, having these women who are not nuns doing this. They need to be nuns. So soon, right after her death, the group is put in a new situation. They're pressured and really sort of forced to become regular nuns, to live in cloister and so forth. Although they still did their teaching and so forth, and as far as I know, they were the first of the teaching orders, they were sort of, in a sense, neutered, if that's the correct word, you know. They were made to fit into that little order, that little way that they can be controlled from on top and so forth. But nevertheless, they had a great effect, and they still do as teachers. And they opened it up for other groups of nuns who teach and so forth. Another person from the first half of the 19th century, some of you may have heard of, was Frederick Ozanam. And he was a French scholar. He was a conservative, actually, and very traditionalist Catholic. And he was involved in these things where he was arguing, you know, with other Catholic scholars about what Catholic, what the church, where, what direction they should be going in. And he would get in debates with Protestants and to show that the Catholic Church is the true church and all this. He did all that kind of stuff that conservatives like to get involved in a lot, but I shouldn't do that, so I won't. But anyway, you know, that kind of thing. And one time he was in a debate, and somebody asked him, well, you know, in the past your church did a lot of things for social justice, but what are they doing now? I don't think they're doing much at all now. And he stopped and he thought. He said, what are they doing for the poor? There's plenty of poor people here in Paris. What are they doing for them? And he thought, maybe they're not doing enough. And so he changed his life to be less of a scholar, but to dedicate himself to feeding the poor. And he was the founder of something that I'm sure you all have heard of, the St. Vincent de Paul Society. And so he was very much involved, spent the rest of his life, as I say, working with the poor in Paris. Now, that's certainly social justice. In my own work, I recently wrote a book that deals with an order of very unusual nuns down in New Orleans that eventually went and became the first African-American Catholic missionaries in what was British Honduras. Today it's Belize. They stayed there for 110 years and had to end their mission when Katrina hit New Orleans. But the founder of that group was a free woman of color named Henriette Delisle. I don't know if any of you all had ever heard of her. If you didn't and you want to, just buy my book. It's expensive, but it's worth it. No, whatever. Roberta will tell you all about it, you know, give you a dollar discount or something. No, but Henriette Delisle, she was this free woman of color, which meant you were about one-eighth or one-fourth of actual African descent, and the rest was white through various things. And these women in our odd, very odd New Orleans society were bred basically to be mistresses to upper-class Spanish and French men. You had your free woman of color on the side and your wife, who knew about it but never said anything. That's the way New Orleans society was, unfortunately. Well, this is what she was supposed to become, but she didn't. For a variety of reasons we don't have time to go into, she said, I want to be a nun. Well, people who were of African descent weren't allowed to be nuns. It didn't stop her. She became a nun. It was really rough. She and the congregation that she founded started educating African-American slaves and free people of color, and they're still doing it down to this day. Now they're the largest community, I believe, of nuns in all of Louisiana at this time. And they're all still virtually all African-American to this day. And they fought prejudice from within their own church and from within secular society. And yet they persevered. And as I say, they've done incredible work. So that's another example. And then more current people, everyone here, I would hope, and if you haven't, you should, has heard of Dorothy Day, who's one of my favorite people in all of history. Dorothy Day was a woman from the South, became a journalist and a communist, and had a pretty wild younger years. And then something happened, and she decided that that wasn't the way to live. And she converted to Catholicism. And she found at that time, in the early 1930s, late 1920s, early 1930s, that the Catholic Church just didn't meet the social justice criteria that she thought it should meet, and that she thought everyone should meet. Because when she was a communist because, you know, she thought that that was the way to go for social justice. And now that she became a Catholic, she said, well, I don't see things being done the way they should be done. So she changed that. And she got into radical social justice, which drove the Catholic bishops crazy. They didn't know how to handle this woman, but at least they gave her the leeway to do what she wanted to do, and she did it well. And as a historian, I've read many times many historians who called Dorothy Day the most influential Catholic of the 20th century, which is interesting. But as I say, her Catholicism was radical Catholicism. I mean, it was take no prisoners. I mean, this was real social justice. To the fullest extent, the extent that I could never live. So that's another example. And maybe you've all heard of Thomas Merton. Thomas Merton, again, he was a convert to Catholicism. And he wanted to be a Franciscan, but when he went and talked to them and told them about his past life, they said, whoa, I'm sorry, but with that kind of a past life, we don't think you'll fit in here. So one thing led to another, and he became a Trappist monk, the most rigid of all monasticism within the Catholic Church. And he took that position as a Catholic monk behind, you know, walls, cloistered walls, and eventually living in a little hermitage. And from there, he wrote about, again, radical social justice and became quite famous. When Pope Francis came here and he talked about Americans, he talked about that guy Martin that my grandson was talking about, Dorothy Day and Thomas Merton. They were the three people that he talked about. So Thomas Merton is quite a guy. And I'll give one last example before I get into the real nitty-gritty of this stuff. At the end of World War II, there were many Catholic intellectuals and others who thought, you know, we can't have this happen again. We can't have another world war. We can't. And why is this? It's because we lack social justice in our world. And so we need social justice. So these Catholics came together, if I'm correct, I think it was in France at first, eventually in the United States, but I'm not positive on that. And they founded an organization called Pax Christi. Some of you may have heard of Pax Christi. And it's basically a Catholic peace organization. And again, they do radical social justice peace work. And they do an incredible job. That organization spread throughout the world. And sometimes they'll call me and ask me to do something with them. I say, man, that's going too far, you know. I don't know if I want to do it. And my wife says, yes, you will, and we do it. But, you know, that's another example of that kind of Catholic social justice that I'm talking about. But modern Catholic social justice really got its what would you say, emphasis or whatever. In the 19th century, as a result of the coming of industrialization to Europe and the United States, as you know, I'm sure, industrialization brought some incredible new problems with poverty and misery. People working in factories 7 days a week, 12, 15 hours a day, making not enough to even survive, and so forth. And so these were real problems. And the Catholic Church was a church that had really a history of living in a community where most people were farmers, you know, either nobles or peasants and so forth. And now this was a new world with new problems that, you know, in 1400 people wouldn't have even thought could possibly have existed. So what do you do? Well, one of the great popes of the Catholic Church, Pope Leo XIII, in 1891 put out an encyclical letter which became famous, and it was the first what we call social justice encyclicals of the Catholic Church. And it's called Rerum Novarum. Some of you may have heard of it. And basically what he was concerned with was, as I say, the breakdown of society as a result of industrialization, the industrial economy of the West. And in this encyclical, he talked about the misery of workers and said workers have a right to demand dignity and just wages and so forth. And that means they have a right to organize and to form unions so that they can get a decent wage. Now, that was the first time that you heard of something like that in the Catholic Church. I mean, not that they were condemning unions or anything. They weren't saying anything. But that really, the Church came out in favor of unions. And as a historian, I can tell you that was really important, especially in the United States when enormous numbers, well, they had already been starting, had been coming over here, millions of Irish and German and Italian and Polish and so forth, immigrants coming to the United States for a new life, for a new chance. And the fact that they were able to join unions was really important. In certain other countries where they had come earlier, they weren't able to do that, and the church and Christianity in general lost these people. You know, forever. But in the United States, the Catholic Church has a very good record of working with immigrants who came here for social justice. And that's partly, you know, as I say, a result of what Pope Leo XIII said. And that's, you know, not just in the United States, obviously. In that encyclical, he talked about all the negatives of socialism and communism on the one hand, but he also talked about the negatives of what we would call laissez-faire capitalism and how factory owners don't have a right to just become rich on the backs of the poor. That capital and labor have to work for justice for everybody and so forth. And this was a really, really important encyclical, and the first of these encyclicals. He also talked in there about people have a right, as many more conservative Catholics have been arguing for a long time, and well-off Catholics, they have a right to private property. But that right is limited. You have a right to private property, but not to accumulate at the expense of others. And so if others are suffering, that their misery, their suffering supersedes your right to accumulate enormous amount of private property. And that's a pretty important thing. So that was the first of these social justice encyclicals. And there were many that came after, and I'm not going to sit here and talk about all of them because you'll all leave very quickly. You'll get so bored. But a few I do want to mention very briefly. One of my favorite people of all time is Pope John the 23rd, and you all have heard of him. In fact, if I can digress for a second, I had gotten, right before I came to La Roche, I had gotten an NEH grant, all expenses paid, to go to Rome and do some scholarly work for 8 weeks. And my wife came for the first 4 weeks and then went home, and I was real lonely by myself there. And I would get... when I got really lonely, I would go to St. Peter's at the Vatican, and I would go down into the basement where all the popes were buried. Now, this was 1983, I think, something like that. And I would go to Pope John's, the place where he was buried, and you'd have all these Italians, men and women, walking through and, you know, talking and whatever, you know. Italians are not good for being, you know, obeying all the rules, in a sense, which is one thing I kind of like about them. But they would be walking by, paying very little attention, no deference, and they'd get to John the 23rd's grave, they would stop. There would be no talking. And the women would kneel down and bless themselves, and you could start praying. And the men, they didn't want to do that. They'd stand, but you could see they would be praying. And that really moved me, because he was the Pope of the people. The popes had gotten away from the people, at least in my opinion, and I'm right there, I think. But he was the Pope of the people, and he put out, as soon as he became Pope, and he wasn't supposed to be Pope, he was a compromise. You know, they figured he'd kick off pretty quickly, and then the two different factions could start fighting again, and maybe they'd be ready, you know, to be better, you know, to get their guy elected. But he put out two of these social justice encyclicals that are really important. And at that time, I was studying to be a priest. I was in the seminary, and these things meant a lot to me. I was in the seminary during Vatican II, which was quite a time to be in the seminary or to be a Catholic. And the first of his encyclicals was Mater et Magistra, and that was put out in 1961. And there, he discussed, again, what was happening throughout the world, the ever-increasing disproportionate relationship between people who work in agriculture. What he was talking about is how fewer people and big corporations are gobbling up more and more of the arable land, of the farmland, making smaller farmers in poverty, putting them in poverty. And how, as Christians, we all need to work to make sure that this doesn't continue, to do something about this. This is not the way it should be, that a small group of people own more and more of the wealth, more and more of the land and more of the wealth, and that Christians have to be concerned with this. That was one of the things he talked about there. He also discussed the responsibility of rich nations, in other words, industrialized nations, in relation to developing nations, which at that time we call the Third World, that it's not just for us to keep gobbling up more and more of the wealth of the world at the expense of these countries in Africa, the countries in the South, Africa, Latin America, parts of Asia, where the people are falling deeper and deeper into poverty, while we in the United States and Europe are just, you know, getting more and more stuff, you know? And so that was talked about in Mater et Magistra. And then he put out a second encyclical in 1963, which certainly has affected La Roche College, because we started a program as a result of this encyclical. And this encyclical was called Pacem in Terris. At La Roche, we brought people from conflictive areas, like Rwanda, and the former Yugoslavia, and so forth, and gave them free education, hoping that they would go back to the conflictive area, or at least somewhere, and use what they got to end poverty. And it's been an extremely successful program. Hasn't exactly gone the way we thought it would originally, but that's the way life is. That's the way God is, I guess. But Pacem in Terris was an encyclical in, and it was written right after the Cuban Missile Crisis by John the 23rd, when we came probably closest, at least as far as we know, to obliterating the whole world. And it was an encyclical in response to the Cold War, which was getting out of hand. And in there, John the 23rd outlined a global moral order, how things should be. And it emphasized negotiations have to take precedence over war, especially in the nuclear age. And when a war can mean the end of the earth for all of us. And it also, again, emphasized even more than his earlier one the need for equality between nations. That if we're going to have peace and justice, peace with justice, there has to be equality among nations. And these two encyclicals, of course, not only affected, the second one, Pacem in Terris, was not just written for Catholics. It was written for all people of goodwill. And so the Catholic Church was getting out of its insulation here, which had followed the Protestant Reformation, in a sense, and realizing that, you know, we need to work together with everyone if we're going to have a just world. And so that, and Pacem in Terris did a lot more than just that, but that's, you know, enough for right here, I think. As I say, those social justice encyclicals for us Catholics, they're the base of our modern way of looking at social justice. They basically were looking at relationships after industrialization and how can we have a just world under these under this situation. And then came the big event, the same guy, John the 23rd, and you all know what I'm going to say next, right? Begins with a V and has a 2 after it. Vatican II, right? Second Vatican Council. And there hadn't been a council in the Catholic Church in eons and centuries. And all of a sudden, this old man who has cancer, people didn't realize he was dying with cancer, says, we need to update the Catholic Church. So I'm going to call a council. A council is something where all the bishops from the entire world come together and, you know, they do whatever, you know, needs to be done. And he said, this is going to be a different kind of council. And they talked about aggiornamento, an Italian word, and means basically updating. And he said, the Catholic Church has been too stuffy. It has not been where it should be in relation to the modern world. See, way back in the 19th century, Pius IX, put out something called the Syllabus of Errors. Wasn't going to talk about this, but I might as well. And where he condemned everything that was modern. And there were reasons for that, but it was ridiculous, including democracy, separation of church and state, and all that. And now John the 23rd is saying, these things are antiquated. It's time to move on. It's time to get right with the modern world so that we can affect it and make it more moral, make it more just, more peaceful. And so that's what Vatican II was all about. I'm not sure all these crusty cardinals and bishops realize, well, I am sure, they didn't realize what it was about when it started. But if I can honestly say, as a Catholic, if it was not for the Second Vatican Council, I wouldn't be a Catholic. The Second Vatican Council, I think, more than anything in the last 1,000 years, affected the Catholic Church. So the council lasted from 1962 to 65, and it did all kinds of cool things and great things, ecumenism, as far as the Catholic Church goes. As I was saying, I think to Tom, I got here early and I was standing by a door and I heard them practicing for one of the services here at this Presbyterian church. And they were singing these hymns or songs or whatever you call them with drums and all that. And I was saying, man, I went to church last night because I was coming here. Normally, you know, we have a Saturday thing. But they're the same songs that we sing. All creatures great and strong, it was one, Amazing Grace and so forth. I'm saying, man, in 1950, we didn't sing the same songs as you all. We didn't like you and you didn't like us. And we were both wrong, you know. I often say to my students, you know, after the Reformation, we spent 150 years killing each other. Here we were saying we were killing each other because we're all the ones who are right. We're the correct followers of the Prince of Peace. So therefore, we're going to kill you if you're not like us, and you're going to kill us. All in the name of the Prince of Peace, you know. Something went wrong here, you know. And now it feels good. You come here and you're singing the same things that we're singing. And you invite me here. You wouldn't have done that in 1950. In 1950, if my mother, my wife's mother married a Baptist, and they couldn't have a mass. That was frowned on. In my family, it was frowned on if you married anyone who wasn't Irish, you know. But anyway, that's a different story. And I married someone who was half English, which my mother and grandparents, well, my grandparents never found that out. And they wouldn't had a real problem with that. But anyway, that's another story. So anyway, Vatican II, which is basically the church looking at the modern world and saying, man, we have really failed and we need to update ourselves so that we can be a part of making this a better world, of being better able to address the problems. Now, there's all kinds of stuff that we could talk about Vatican II, but there's one thing that I want to mention. It's the longest document that came out of Vatican II. It's called Gaudium et Spes, probably, which in the English we call it the Church in the Modern World. And this was a phenomenal document, a phenomenal document. It basically said that for too long, we Catholics, and for that matter, we Christians in general, have looked at personal salvation. You know, okay, I have to obey the commandments. I can't steal. I can't covet my neighbor's wife. I can't do this. If I do all those things and I'm saved, fine. That's all what it's all about. And there are still a lot of people who think like that. Look at some of the things that, maybe I shouldn't go there, but was said concerning the last election, and you'll see what I mean. I mean, certain things were just totally ignored, like they're not important at all, you know? And so, personal sin and my personal salvation isn't enough. They're important. But if you want to call yourself a Christian, Gaudium et Spes said, an equally important thing is to look at the poor and the oppressed, the marginalized. And if you see these people and you do nothing, how can you call yourself a Christian? So in other words, what Gaudium et Spes was saying, it was to be a Christian, yes, you have to worry about personal sin and your personal salvation, but you also have to worry about making the kingdom come and God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven. I remember in those days, I never thought of, when I said the Our Father, I never thought of what was being said there, you know? We have to make the kingdom come to earth, not just worry about getting me to heaven. So what Gaudium et Spes also said was, there's another kind of sin that we don't recognize along with personal sin, and it's called structural sin. Does anybody know what structural sin would mean? It's a sin when a society, a country, where the rich and the powerful create a political system, an economic system, you name it, a social system, which keeps the rich richer, or makes them continue to get richer, while it's done on the backs of the poor, while the poor get poorer. And at risk of getting myself in trouble, I can say, I'm going to do it anyway because I always do that, but I look, for instance, at the current bill on health care. And a lot of people with tremendous evangelical support seem to think there's no problem with putting 22 million people without health insurance who got it. And the money that will be saved, what's going to be done with it? He's going because he's an usher. He's not walking. Okay. But what? Yeah, right, exactly. But what's being done with the money that's being saved? It's going to be another massive tax cut for billionaires. I gave a talk recently on Martin Luther King's day. I was the keynote speaker at a breakfast, and I sat with my representative. I won't mention any names. And the president of La Roche College. We were at one table. And my wife, I didn't do it because I had a talk and I was thinking about my talk. I didn't want to. But my wife, she gets in an argument with our congressman concerning the health bill. And all he could say is, I pay $22,000 a year for my health care. Of course, he's a multimillionaire. And, that was it. And my wife said, well, what about all these other people? Well, you know, that wasn't his problem. And he was very upset. But I, as I say, stayed out of it. I was good that time. But, you know, but these are the kind of issues that Gaudium et Spes was talking about. Social sin. Social sin. We have to fight against structures that mean the rich keep getting richer and richer and getting more and more of the wealth of the world on the backs of everybody else. We can't do it. And that's what Gaudium et Spes said. What it also did, which was really cool in Catholicism, was it said traditional theology is nice, but we need to have new kinds of theologies that instead of being from the top down, go from the bottom up. So we look at what are people's problems? What are the problems that they face? And then let's create our theology. Then we look at above, you know, of old traditional theology and so on, and we figure, how can it fit this? You know, how can we deal with the problems of today's world, the sins of today's world, theologically? And the way they did that, for the first time in Catholicism at least, I think Protestants, at least a lot of them, were doing this a lot earlier than us, they said, we need to use the social sciences. So studies like psychology and history and political science and anthropology were all brought into the mix to try and find solutions to the problems of the world. That's what Gaudium et Spes said to do. In Latin America, which I do most of my work on, there, the bishops who went to Vatican II without realizing what they were getting into were so taken by this, they decided when they would come back that they would have a meeting. It was only the second time they ever did that. Of all the bishops, it was at Medellin, Colombia. And there, the bishops said, incredibly, they said, we have been a sinful church. And we apologize for that, basically. We have been a sinful church because we have not done enough for the poor suffering of Latin America. And then the majority. And there were reasons why that was the case, which we don't have time to get into. But they said, henceforth, we will walk with the poor. And they used something called liberation theology, at least some of them did anyway, to try and figure out how to do this. And they said, first of all, too often in history, we've told the poor, okay, if you're poor and miserable, well, God, that must be God's will. And so what you do is you don't make any trouble, you live, you watch your kids without enough food, and eventually you die, probably pretty young, and then you'll get your real reward. God put you in that position. And when you die, then you'll get a high position in heaven because you put up with all this. The church is saying, uh-uh, that ain't the way it is. A just God doesn't do that. A decent God doesn't make you so you can watch your kids starve to death. If your kids are starving to death, it's not God who will that. It's the people in your community, the people in your country. So the church has to walk with the poor. And the church then put together, using the social sciences, all these methods of raising the consciousness of the poor. Meeting in something called comunidades de base, Christian-based communities. And I've sat in on some of these in Central America in my own work, where people would read the Bible and say, how does this now... And most of them couldn't read, so you had to teach them how to read to do this, you know. But you would read the Bible and say, how does this fit into my life, into my own time? So I'll give you one example. it's easier for, a camel to get through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to get to heaven. Okay, we all heard that. I hate to say this, but I was in Rome once on a grant when a priest in church, a very rich church that was during the Reagan administration, all these people from the the U.S. embassy over there and so forth went to this church, and that was the gospel. And the priest spent his time saying, well, that doesn't mean us. That means people who have gotten all of their wealth by cheating other people. And I'm saying, man, do I want to stay here or should I just walk out? You know, I was just disgusted. That's not what it means at all, you know. But that's the way some people used to, and some people still do. Some priests and ministers and so forth still talk like that. And that's not right. But what this all meant was, if you're poor and miserable, this goes against God's will. So you have to figure out, why are you poor and miserable? Well, it's because we do all the work on the fields, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, while the guy up in the big house on the hill doesn't do much at all, except, you know, get together for nice parties and so forth. He makes all the money. We do all the work, you know? So that's what they would come to these conclusions. And so then peasants would start to come together and say, let's form peasant leagues or unions of people in the cities. We're going to form unions. And the priests were with them and the nuns were with them. And, of course, what the church in their naivete didn't realize was that those powerful people weren't going to like that. So people started blaming the church for this new attitude of the poor, saying, we're not going to take it anymore. And priests started to die. They started to be killed. And one bishop, archbishop, who would eventually be killed himself, who was just recently beatified in the Catholic Church. I just finished writing an article on this that just came out this week, in fact, Archbishop Oscar Romero. He changed from a staunch conservative who couldn't see any of this to the greatest champion of the poor. And most of you have probably heard of him. He was murdered in 1980. And the other bishops were uncomfortable with him in El Salvador, and they said, he's making a lot of trouble. He's not supposed to be making trouble. Later, Pope John Paul II was uncomfortable with him and told him, you need to calm it down, you know, and so forth, which he didn't do, thank God. But anyway, you know, this kind of thing was going on. And so the other bishop said that, you know, priests are being killed now by the military and so forth. And it's all his fault because he's involved himself in politics. And instead of going on the defense, he went on the offense. You know what he said? Which, to me, is one of those things that has stuck with me forever, and it's really meant a lot in my life. He said, in a society where people are being murdered every day, where people don't have enough to eat, if, as thousands of people are being murdered, if there were not some priests in that number, then basically we're doing something wrong. The death of these priests, far from being something we should say, oh, this is horrible, it's all Oscar Romero's fault. No, the death of these priests means that the church is incarnated in its people, that we are part of the people in their struggle for justice. And so these are the kind of things, half hour? Okay. These are the kind of things that came out of Gaudium et Spes and Vatican II and the, in Latin America, the conference at Medellin. Because of this new Vatican II type of church, we, more than probably any other churches in the world, well, I guess any churches or synagogues or whatever in the world, we have this hierarchical structure which has its good points and its bad points. And it has both, believe me. But one thing that it enables us to do is, as a church, to be able to put out some pretty effective international organizations to feed the poor. And for instance, I'll just mention two real quick and then I'll get into some other stuff. But Caritas, you may have heard of Caritas, and Catholic Relief Services. Well, Caritas internationally is probably the most effective relief agency, agency feeding the poor in the entire world. And there are other institutions like that. And again, as a Catholic, I taught on semester at sea. I think it was 1999 or 2000. I did it twice, but I think it was somewhere around there. And we at that time, we went through Asia. And we went to countries like Malaysia, where there's virtually no Catholics. And in the little city where I was, there was an orphanage. And there are three different ethnic groups there. They don't kill each other, but they don't like each other either. And they don't interrelate to each other very much. And this orphanage had people from all three of those groups. And it was run by the Catholic Church. Nobody else was doing an orphanage. We went to India. We went to Mother Teresa's place. She had just died. She would have met us, but she had died just a few weeks earlier. And I saw, you know, the work they were doing there. And it reminded me of this Christopher Hitchens, who wrote a book saying that, oh, she was a big phony and all this. And, no, believe me, go there. They're not phonies. When you see what was being done, it was incredible. This is in India, where most of the people are Hindu or Muslim. And everywhere I went, I saw agencies that were working to alleviate poverty of the poor. Now, there were other churches that were doing this also in these places. But the Catholic Church being so big and so this kind of system that they have, were able to do it on a large scale because of that. So there's a lot of good things like that that were going on. Okay, so that's basically the talk. So let's get back to the way I started now. Why would that woman say, well, I was a Catholic, but the Catholic Church doesn't believe in social justice. And, so therefore I became an Episcopalian. Well, as I say, that bothered me a lot, and I thought a lot about it. And I'll leave you with a little story that in the last article that I wrote that just came out this week. There was a priest. I was asked by, I'm not going to say the city or anything, but I was asked to go on this local religious TV show that the Catholic Church had in this particular city. And I was supposed to talk about Oscar Romero. It was the fifth anniversary of his martyrdom, of his death. And so I got there early. You know, they make the show in the daytime and then show it at night or something like that. And yeah. So I'm sitting there waiting, and there's other segments here, and this well-coiffed priest with every hair in place, all his clothes totally beautifully ironed and so forth, comes in and sits down and says, well, hello, I'm so-and-so. And this priest would later become a cardinal, I might add, but I don't want to, you know. And he sits down, he starts talking. Well, being the obnoxious person that my wife tells me I am, and I was worse then, I've gotten a lot better, I've worked on this, but anyway, I said to him, and I always say it was very innocently, and my wife says, sure. I said, this is the fifth anniversary of the murder of Oscar Romero, and this diocese is doing nothing. Shouldn't this be something that is commemorated on the fifth anniversary? And what he said was, well, you have to understand. See, in the church, he was the head of the seminary at the time. As I say, later he would become a cardinal. And he said, in the church, we teach our seminarians, our future priests, something called prudential judgment. And he said, that means that if there's a controversial thing, we try to stay away from that in the pulpit. You can do that outside, but not from church itself, because it's controversial and it will upset people. So, whoa, you know? So, of course, me being, I can't ever, as my wife says, shut my mouth and leave it alone. So I said, in other words, you might upset some people and you won't get any money in the collection, right? Well, that started it. That started it. And when he went out there for his segment, which was on something else, his hair, he had at least three or four hairs out of place and so forth, you know? And then we did our thing and we were the last ones. And the priest who was doing the show came out and said, what did you all do? I've never seen him like that. He was so upset, you know? And I went and told that to certain priests and nuns that I know that story and said, he's being groomed to be a bishop, you know? And I think that's part of the problem. I'd call it prudential judgment. I think too often what we do in the Catholic Church, and we're not alone, but too often we worry about how will this look? How will this look? So even the good that we do, people don't see it because we keep it out of the church. In my own church, which is very social justice oriented, the priest doesn't say anything from the pulpit. He'll have things like this, and we do things like this, and that's great. But I think sometimes we need to call people out from the pulpit when things are being done that are wrong. We need to say it and not use prudential judgment. And I think that's why so many people think we don't have social justice in the Catholic Church, because too often we have to be you know, protect that institution. And boy, that got us into a lot of trouble. Sure. Yeah, so anybody have any questions or whatever? And don't worry about prudential judgment here, you know. Yes.
On the question of personal motivation, I hesitate to use the word obligation because I think that has a special meaning in your tradition, but is there an obligation on Catholics through their theology, through their belief system, to be involved in the social justice?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Sure. There was a guy, I think his name was Joseph Donders, but I'm not sure if I got the right one, who wrote a book called Catholic Social Justice, The Church's Greatest Secret. And I think that says it all. We have always preached social justice since the beginning of the church. But, again, too often, there's too many people who don't do it. We got a new pastor in our church who we didn't like him. And I was one of four people elected to make trouble and to have the bishop remove him. And yes, which is amazing because you never succeed in the Catholic Church with those things, you know. But I had to meet with priests and everything and this guy, and he was saying, well, and we brought up, you know, he doesn't care about social justice. And he said, well, it's not that I don't care about it. It's just not important to me. My thing is the liturgy, having a strong liturgy. I'm not kidding. That's what he said. So I said, a liturgy. I said, let's look at the New Testament. Read every page. You're going to see social justice there. You know, feed the poor. I don't see anything about the liturgy there. And the other priest started to giggle, you know. And he was removed. And I was good. But this is the point. It's there, and we've done it well, but we've held back too much. And so has, I'm sure, the Presbyterian Church and the Baptist Church. We all do that. We need to commit ourselves, all churches, and Islam and Judaism, more deeply to social justice. Who is it? G.K. Chesterton, a convert in the 1920s or 30s, an Englishman, a curmudgeon, a convert to Catholicism, from the Anglican Church, and he made that famous statement, if you want, you know, to solve all the problems of the world could be solved through Christianity. It's a shame that no one's ever discovered it. And I think that, you know, of course he was exaggerating, but there's something there, you know? I mean, to me, and I say this when I fight with other people in my faith and in other faiths, I say, you know, to me, all this stuff, you can have all these social battles that I think are ridiculous that we have in various Christian faiths and so forth. But what it all boils down to is you love God and therefore you do what God wants you to do. And that is you care about your fellow man and woman. If you can't do that, then you're not being a good Christian. And I look at the world today and I see these people who can get up and speak out as Christians, for certain politicians, for instance. And I say, we failed. I look at our own country. Since the end of World War II, we've been in almost perpetual war. Perpetual war. How many religious people are talking about that? Not many. Not many. You know, I'll leave you, since Roberta's one of those science people, and she's going to, you know, they're much more, what do you call it, the way I should be. But... But I'll leave you with this story. When Martin Luther King, you know, back to my grandson, you know, when he was doing his thing Selma took place, prior to Selma in the Catholic Church, the bishops did not want priests and nuns to go out and walk in demonstrations. Why? If the demonstrations were for justice, why didn't they want them to walk out there? Because it was unseemly. Unseemly. Why people with Roman collars on and nuns' habits. They shouldn't, you know. So anyway, they weren't allowed to do that. And finally, the Cardinal of St. Louis, when John Lewis and the others were being beaten, said, enough of this. He called the orders of nuns, and they came out there, including this black nun, and they protested with Martin Luther King. And I know Roberta's saying, Ed, shut up. So I will. But I went down with my wife to redo Selma. I did an article on it in the Post-Gazette a few months ago. And there in the big museum was this black Catholic nun right there, right behind Martin Luther King. I met her. I interviewed her. And she was there walking with him. And I was never more proud than at that moment as a Catholic to see her in that museum in Selma, Alabama, where there's virtually no Catholics. And that's what social justice is about. So it's not just Catholic social justice. It's you and me, Presbyterian social justice, Catholic. We're all together in this. Thank you.